Chapter 14. What Wise Ones Know. Halwyn Norrie, the first clerk, and Rena Harfour, the first maid, entered together, him making a jerky, unpracticed bow, and her a graceful curtsy that was neither too low nor too shallow. They could not have been more different. Mistress Harfour was round-faced and regally dignified, her hair in a neat grey bun atop her head. Master Norrie, tall and gawky as a wading bird, with his little remaining hair sticking up behind his ears like sprays of white feathers. Each carried an embossed leather folder stuffed with papers, but she held hers at her side as if not to rumple her formal scarlet tabard, unwrinkled as it always seemed to be, no matter the hour or how long she had been on her feet. While he clutched his folder to his narrow chest as if to hide old ink stains, of which several spotted his tabard, including a large blot that made the white lion's tail end in a black tuft. Courtesies done, they immediately put a little distance between them, each not quite watching the other. As soon as the door closed behind Rasoria, the glow of Sidar sprung up around Avienda, and she wove a ward against eavesdropping that clung to the walls of the room. What was said between them was now as safe as they could make it, and Avienda would know if anyone even tried to listen with the power. She was very good with this sort of weave. "Mistress Harfour," Elaine said, "if you will begin." She did not offer wine or seats, of course. Master Norrie would have been shocked to his toenails by such a lapse in the proprieties, and Mistress Harfour might well have been offended. As it was, Norrie twitched and glanced sideways at Rena, and her mouth thinned. Even after a week's meetings, their dislike for giving their reports where the other could hear was palpable. They were jealous of their fiefs, the more so since the first maid had moved into territory that once might have been considered Master Norrie's responsibility. Of course, running the royal palace had always been the first maid's charge, and it might be said that her new duties were only an extension of that. It would not be said by Halwyn Norrie, though. The blazing logs settled in the fireplace with a loud crack, sending a shower of sparks up the chimney. "I am convinced the second librarian is a spy, my lady," Mistress Harfour said finally, ignoring Norrie as if to make him disappear. She had resisted letting anyone else know that she was searching out spies in the palace, yet the first clerk knowing seemed to grate on her worst of all. His only authority over her, if such it was, came from paying the palace accounts, and he never questioned an expenditure. But even that little was more than she wished. "Every 3 or 4 days, Master Harnder visits an inn called the Hoop and Arrow, supposedly for the ale made by the innkeeper, one Millis Fendry. But Mistress Fendry also keeps pigeons, and whenever Master Harnder visits, she sends off a pigeon that flies north. Yesterday, 3 of the Aes Sedai staying at the Silver Swan found reason to visit the Hoop and Arrow, though it caters to a much poorer crowd than the Swan. They came and went hooded, and were closeted with Mistress Fendry in private for over an hour. All 3 are brown Aja. I fear that indicates Master Harnder's employer."
"Hairdressers, footmen, cooks, the master cabinet maker, no fewer than 5 of Master Norrie's clerks, and now one of the librarians."
Leaning back in her chair and crossing her legs, Dailin glowered sourly. "Is there anyone we won't eventually learn is a spy, Mistress Halfour?" Norrie stretched his neck uncomfortably. He took the malfeasance of his clerks as a personal affront.
"I have hopes I may be reaching the bottom of that barrel, my lady," Mistress Harfour said complacently.
Neither spies nor the high seats of powerful houses ruffled her. Spies were pests she intended to rid the palace of as surely as she kept it clear of fleas and rats, though she had been forced to accept Aes Sedai aid with rats recently, while powerful nobles were like rain or snow, facts of nature to be endured until they went away, but nothing to get flustered over. There are only so many people who can be bought, and only so many can afford to buy or want to. Elaine tried to picture Master Harnder, but all she could bring up in her mind was vague, a chubby, balding man who blinked incessantly. He had served her mother, and, as she recalled, Queen Mordrellin before that.
No one commented on the fact that it seemed he also served the brown Aja. Every ruler's palace between the spine of the world and the Arith Ocean contained the tower's eyes and ears. Any ruler with half a brain expected it. Doubtless the Shanshan would soon be living under the White Tower's gaze, too, if they were not already. Rena had discovered several spies for the Red Aja, assuredly legacies of Elida's time in Camelon, but this librarian was the first for another Aja. Elida would not have liked other Ajas knowing what went on in the palace while she was advisor to the queen. "A pity we have no false stories we want the brown Aja to believe," she said lightly. A great pity they and the Reds knew about the kin. At best, they had to know there were a large number of women in the palace who could channel, and it would not take them long to figure out who they were. That would create any number of problems down the road, yet those difficulties did lie somewhere in the future. "Always plan ahead," Lini used to say, "but worry too hard over next year and you can trip over tomorrow." "Watch Master Harnder and try to find out his friends. That will have to suffice for the time being." Some spies depended on their ears, either to hear gossip or listen at doors. Others lubricated tongues with a few friendly cups of wine. The first part of counteracting a spy was to find out how he learned what he sold. Avienda snorted loudly, and spreading her skirts, started to sit down on the carpet before realizing what she wore. With a warning glance at Dialin, she perched stiffly on the front edge of a chair instead, the picture of a court lady with her eyes flashing, except that a lady of the court would not have checked the edge of her belt knife with a thumb. Left to her own devices, Avienda would slit every spy's throat as soon as it could be stretched for the knife. Spying was a vile business in her view, no matter how often Elaine explained that every spy found was a tool that could be used to make her enemies believe what she wanted. Not that every spy necessarily worked for an enemy. Most of those the First Maid had uncovered took money from more than one source, and among those she had identified were King Roedron of Murundi, various Tyran high lords and ladies, a handful of Kyrianin nobles, and a fair number of merchants. A good many people were interested in what happened in Camelon, whether for its effect on trade or other reasons. Sometimes it seemed that everyone spied on everyone else. "Mistress Harfour," she said, "you haven't found any eyes and ears for the Black Tower." Like most people who heard the Black Tower mentioned, Dialin shivered and took a deep drink of her wine, but Rena just grimaced faintly. She had decided to ignore the fact that they were men who could channel, since she could not change matters. To her, the Black Tower was an annoyance. "They haven't had time, my lady. Give them a year and you'll find footmen and librarians taking their coin, too."
"I suppose I will," Dreadful thought.
"What else do you have for us today?"
"I've had a word with John Skellet, my lady. A man who turns his coat once is often amenable to turning it again, and Skellet is."
Skellet, a barber, was in the pay of House Aron, which for the present made him Aramilla's man. Birgitta bit off an oath in mid-word. For some reason she tried to watch her language around Rena Harfour, and spoke in a pained voice.
"You had a word with him? Without asking anyone?"
Dialin was under no compunctions regarding the First Maid, and she muttered, "Mother's milk in a cup." Elaine had never heard her use an obscenity before. Master Norrie blinked and almost dropped his folder, and busied himself with not looking at Dialin. The First Maid, however, merely paused until sure she and Birgitta were done, then went on calmly.
"The time seemed ripe, and so did Skellet. One of the men he hands his reports to left the city and hasn't returned yet, while it appears the other broke his leg. The streets are always icy where a fire has been put out."
She said that so blandly it seemed more than likely she had engineered the man's fall somehow. Hard times uncovered hard talents in the most surprising people.
"Skellet is quite agreeable to carrying his next communication out to the camps himself. He saw a gateway made, and he won't have to pretend terror."
You would have thought she herself had been seeing merchants' wagons rumble out of holes in the air for her entire life.
"What's to stop this barber keeping on running once he's outside the city?
Birgitta demanded irritably,
beginning to pace in front of the fire with her hands clasped behind her. Her heavy golden braid should have been bristling. If he goes, Aron will hire somebody else, and you'll have to hunt him out all over again. Light Aramilla must have heard of the gateways almost as soon as she arrived, and Skellet has to know it. It was not the thought of Skellet escaping that irritated her, or not only that. The mercenaries thought they had been hired to stop soldiers, but for a few silvers they would allow one or two to slip through the gates by night in either direction. One or two could do no harm, as they saw matters. Birgitta did not like being reminded of that.
"Greed will stop him, my lady," Mistress Harfour replied calmly. "The thought of earning gold from the Lady Elaine as well as from Lady Nayan is enough to make the man breathe hard. It's true Lady Aramilla must already have heard of the gateways, but that only adds credit to Skellet's reason for going in person."
"And if his greed is great enough for him to try earning still more gold by turning his coat a third time," Dialin said, "he could cause a great deal of mischief, Mistress Harfour."
Rena's tone became a little crisper. She would never step over the boundaries, but she disliked anyone thinking her careless. "Lady Nayan would have him buried under the nearest snowdrift, my lady, as I made certain he is aware. She has never been patient, as I am sure you are aware. In any case, the news we get from the camps is quite sparse, to say the least, and he might see a few things we would like to know."
"If Skellet can tell us which camp Aramilla, Elenia, and Nayan will be in and when, I'll give him his gold with my own hand," Elaine said deliberately. Elenia and Nayan stayed close to Aramilla, or she kept them close, and Aramilla was much less patient than Nayan, much less willing to believe that anything could function without her presence. She spent half of each day riding from camp to camp, and never slept in the same two nights running as far as anyone could learn. "That is the only thing he can tell us of the camps that I want to know." Rena inclined her head.
"As you say, my lady, I will see to it."
She too often tried not to say things straight out in front of Nori, but she gave no sign that she had heard any reproof. Of course, Elaine was not sure she actually would rebuke the woman openly. Mistress Harfour would continue to perform her duties properly if she did, and she certainly would continue hunting spies with undiminished ardor, if for no other reason than their presence in the palace offended her. Yet Elaine might find a dozen inconveniences in every day, a dozen small discomforts that added up to misery, and not a one that she could directly attribute to the first maid. "We must follow the steps of the dance as surely as our servants," her mother had told her once. "You can keep hiring new servants and spend all your time training them and suffering till they learn, only to find yourself back where you started. Or you can accept the rules as they do and live comfortably while you use your time to rule." "Thank you, Mistress Harfour," she said, for which she received another precise curtsy. Rena Harfour was another who knew her own worth. "Master Nori?" The heron-like man gave a start and stopped, frowning at Rena. In some ways he saw the gateways as his and not to be trifled with.
"Yes, my lady, of course."
His voice was a dusty monotone.
"I trust the Lady Birgitta already has informed you of the merchant's trains from Ilion and Tyr. I believe that is, her usual custom when you return to the city."
For a moment his eyes rested reproachfully on Birgitta. He would never think of causing Elaine the smallest irritation even if she shouted at him, but he lived by his own set of rules, and in a mild fashion he resented Birgitta stealing his chance to enumerate the wagons and casks and barrels that had arrived. He did love his numbers. At least, Elaine supposed it was in a mild fashion. There seemed to be very little heat in Master Nori. "She did," she told him, with just a hint of apology, not enough to embarrass him. "I fear some of the sea folk are leaving us. We'll only have half the number to make gateways after today." His fingers spidered across the leather folder against his chest, as though feeling the papers within. She had never seen him consult one.
Ah, we shall cope, my lady."
Halwyn Nori always coped.
"To continue, There were 9 arsons yesterday and last night, slightly more than usual. 3 attempts were made to fire warehouses storing food. None successful, I hasten to add.
He might hasten to add, yet he did it in that same drone.
If I may say so, the guards patrolling the streets are having an effect. The number of assaults and thefts has declined to little more than normal for this time of year, but it seems evident that some hand is directing the arsons. 17 buildings were destroyed, all save one abandoned.
His mouth narrowed in disapproval. It would take far more than a siege to make him leave Camelin.
And in my opinion, all of the fires were placed so as to draw the water wagons as far as possible from the warehouses where attempts were made. I now believe that pattern holds for every fire we've seen these past weeks.
Birgitta, Elaine said.
I can try plotting the warehouses on a map, Birgitta replied doubtfully, and put extra guards on the streets that seem to be farthest away, but it's still leaving a lot to chance.
She did not look toward Mistress Harfour, but Elaine felt a faint hint of a blush from her.
Anybody can have flint and steel in a belt pouch, and it only takes a minute with some dry straw to start a fire.
Do what you can, Elaine told her. It would be pure luck if they caught an arsonist in the act, and beyond luck if the arsonist could say more than that she had been handed coin by someone with a hood hiding her face. Tracing that gold back to Aramilla or Elania or Nayan would require Matt Cawthon's luck.
Have you anything more, Master Norrie?
Knuckling his long nose, he avoided her gaze.
It has, come to my attention, he said hesitantly, that Marn, Aron, and Sarand have all recently taken very large loans against the revenues of their estates.
Mistress Harfour's eyebrows climbed before she got them under control. Peering into her teacup, Elaine discovered that she had actually emptied it. Bankers never told anyone how much they had loaned, to whom, or against what, but she did not ask how he knew. It would be embarrassing for both of them. She smiled when her sister took the cup, then grimaced when Avienda returned with it filled again. Avienda seemed to think she should drink weak tea till her eyes floated. Goat's milk was better, but dishwater for tea would do. Well, she would hold the bloody cup, but she did not have to drink.
The mercenaries! Dailin growled, the heat in her eyes enough to make a bear back up. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The trouble with sellswords is they don't always stay bought.
She had opposed hiring mercenaries to help defend the city from the start, though the fact was that without them, Aramilla could have ridden in with her army by any gate she picked, or near enough. There simply had not been enough men to guard every gate properly otherwise, much less man the walls. Birgitta had opposed the mercenaries too, yet she had accepted Elaine's reasons, if reluctantly. She still distrusted them, but now she shook her head. Sitting on the arm of a chair near the fire, she rested her spurred boot on the seat.
Mercenaries have a concern for their reputations, if not their honor. Changing sides is one thing. Actually betraying a gate is something else entirely. A company that did that would never be hired again anywhere. Aramilla would have to offer enough for a captain to live the rest of his life like a lord, and at least convince his men they'd be able to as well.
Norrie cleared his throat. Even that sounded dusty somehow.
It seems they may have borrowed against the same revenues twice or even 3 times. The bankers, of course, are unaware of this as yet.
Birgitta began to curse, then cut herself off. Dailin scowled at her wine hard enough to make it turn sour. Avienda squeezed Elaine's hand, just a quick pressure, quickly released. The fire crackled in a shower of sparks, some nearly reaching the carpets.
The mercenary companies will have to be watched.
Elaine raised a hand to forestall Birgitta. The other woman had not opened her mouth, but the bond shouted volumes.
You will have to find the men for it somewhere.
Light. They seem to be guarding against as many people inside the city as outside.
It shouldn't take that many, but we need to know if they start to act strangely or secretively, Birgitta. That might be our only warning.
I was thinking what to do if one of the companies does sell out, Birgitta said wryly. Knowing won't be enough unless I have men to rush to any gate I think is going to be betrayed. And half the soldiers in the city are mercenaries. Half the rest are old men who were living on their pensions a few months gone. I'll shift the mercenaries' postings at irregular intervals. It will be harder for them to betray a gate if they can't be sure where they'll be tomorrow, but that doesn't make it impossible.
Protest how she would that she was no general, she had seen more battles and sieges than any 10 generals living, and she knew very well how these matters unfolded. Elaine almost wished she had wine in her cup. Almost.
Is there any chance the bankers will learn what you have, Master Norrie, before the loans come due?
If they did, some might decide they preferred Aramilla on the throne. She could strip the country's coffers to repay those loans, then. She might even do it. Merchants rode the political winds whichever way they blew. Bankers had been known to attempt to influence events.
In my opinion, it is unlikely, my lady. They would have to, ask the right questions of the right people, but bankers are normally, close-mouthed with one another. Yes, I think it unlikely, for the time being.
There was nothing to be done in any case, except to tell Birgitta there might be a new source for assassins and kidnappers. Only given her hard expression and a sudden grimness in the bond, she'd already realized that. There would be little chance of keeping the bodyguard under 100 women now, if there ever had been.
Thank you, Master Norrie, Elaine said. You've done well, as always. Let me know immediately if you see any indications that the bankers have asked those questions.
Of course, my lady, he murmured, ducking his head like an egret darting after a fish. My lady is very kind.
When Rena and Norrie left the room, him holding the door for her and making a bow that was a hair more graceful than usual, and her giving him a slight bow of her head as she glided past him into the corridor, Avienda did not release the ward she was holding. As soon as the door closed, its solid sound swallowed by the ward, she said, "Someone tried to listen." Elaine shook her head. There was no way to tell who. A black sister? A curious kinswoman? But at least the eavesdrop had failed. Not that there was much chance of anyone getting past one of Avienda's wards, maybe not even the Forsaken, but she would have spoken up right away if someone had.
Dailin took Avienda's announcement with less aplomb, muttering about the sea folk. She had not turned a hair at hearing that half the Windfinders were leaving, not in front of Rena and Norrie, but now she demanded to know the whole story.
I never did trust Zyda, she grumbled when Elaine finished. This agreement sounds good for trade, I suppose, but it wouldn't surprise me if she had one of the Windfinders try to listen in. She struck me as a woman who wants to know everything, just in case it might be useful one day.
There was very little hesitant about Dailin, yet she hesitated now, rolling her wine cup between her palms.
Are you certain this beacon can't harm us, Elaine?
As certain as I can be, Dailin. If it was going to crack open the world, I think it would have by now.
Avienda laughed, but Dailin turned quite pale. Really? Sometimes you had to laugh, if only to keep from crying.
If we tarry much longer now that Norrie and Mistress Harfour are gone, Birgitta said, somebody might start wondering why.
She waved a hand at the walls, indicating the ward she could not see. She knew it was still in place, though. The daily meetings with the first maid and the first clerk always concealed a little something more.
Everyone gathered around her as she moved a pair of golden seafolk porcelain bowls on one of the side tables and pulled a much-folded map from inside her short coat. It rode there always, except when she slept, and then it resided beneath her pillow. Spread out, with empty wine cups at the corners to hold it flat, the map displayed Andor from the river Arinon to the border between Altara and Murundi. In truth, it could have been said to show all of Andor,
since what lay farther west had been only half under Camelin's control for generations. It had hardly been a masterpiece of the mapmaker's art to begin with, and creases obscured much of the detail, but it showed the terrain well enough, and every town and village was marked, every road and bridge and ford. Elaine set her teacup down at arm's length from the map to avoid spilling on it and adding more stains, and to rid herself of the wretched excuse for tea. "The Borderlanders are moving," Birgitta said, pointing to the forests north of Camelin, to a spot above Andor's northmost border. "But they haven't covered much ground. At this rate, they'll be well over a month getting close to Camelin." Swirling her silver cup, Dailan peered into the dark wine, then looked up suddenly. "I thought you northerners were used to snow, Lady Birgitta." Even now she had to probe, and telling her not to would only make her 10 times as certain that Birgitta was hiding secrets, and 20 times as determined to learn them. Avienda scowled at the older woman. When she was not in awe of Birgitta, sometimes she became fiercely protective of Birgitta's secrets. But Birgitta herself met Dialin's gaze levelly, with no hint of alarm in the bond. She had become quite comfortable with the lie about her origins. "I haven't been back to Candor in a long time." That was simple truth, though it had been far longer than Dailan could have imagined. The country had not even been called Candor then. "But no matter what you're used to, moving 200,000 soldiers, not to mention the light alone knows how many camp followers, is slow going in winter. Worse, I sent Mistress Okalin and Mistress Fote to visit some of the villages a few miles south of the border." Sabena Okalin and Julania Fote were kinswomen who could travel. "They say the villagers think the Borderlanders are camped for the winter." Elaine tisked, frowning at the map as she traced distances with a finger. She was counting on news of the Borderlanders, if not on the Borderlanders themselves. Word of an army that size entering Andor should be leaping ahead of it like wildfire in dry grass. No one but a fool could believe they had marched all those hundreds of leagues to try conquering Andor, but everyone who heard would be speculating on their intentions and what to do about them, a different opinion on every tongue. Once the news began to spread, anyway. When it did, she had an advantage over everyone else. She had arranged for the Borderlanders to cross into Andor in the first place, and she had already arranged for them to leave. The choice had not been very difficult. Stopping them would have been a bloody affair, if it could have been managed at all, and they wanted no more than the width of a road to march onward into Murundi, where they thought they would find the dragon reborn. That was her doing as well. They hid their reason for seeking Rand, and she was not about to give them a true location, not when they had as many as 12 Aes Sedai with them and hid that fact, too. But once news of them reached the high seats... "It should work," she said softly. "If necessary, we can plant rumors of the Borderlanders ourselves." "It should work," Dailan agreed, then added in a dark voice, "as long as Bashir and Bale keep a close rein on their men. It's going to be a volatile mix, with Borderlanders, Aiel, and the Legion of the Dragon all within a few miles of one another, and I can't see how we can be sure the Ashaman won't do something mad." She ended with a sniff. In her book, a man had to be mad in the first place, or he would never have chosen to become an Ashaman. Avienda nodded. She disagreed with Dailan almost as frequently as Birgitta did, but for the most part, the Ashaman were one thing they agreed on. "I'll make sure the Borderlanders stay well clear of the Black Tower," Elaine reassured them, though she had done the same before. Even Dailan knew that Bale and Bashir would hold their forces in check. Neither man wanted a battle he did not need, and Dovram Bashir certainly would not fight his own countrymen. But anyone had a right to be uneasy about the Ashaman and what they might do. She slid her finger from the 6-pointed star identifying Camelin across the few miles to the ground the Ashaman had usurped. The Black Tower was not marked, but she knew all too well exactly where it lay. At least that was well away from the Lugard Road. Sending the Borderlanders south into Murundi without upsetting the Ashaman would not be difficult.
Her mouth compressed at the thought that she must not upset the Ashaman, but there was nothing to be done about it any time soon, so she mentally shifted the black-coated men to one side. What could not be dealt with now had to be dealt with later. And the others? She did not have to say more. 6 major houses remained uncommitted, at least to her or Aramilla. Dailin claimed they would all come to Elaine eventually, but they showed no sign of it so far. Sabaina and Julania had been looking for word of those 6, too. Both women had spent the last 20 years as peddlers, accustomed to hard journeys, sleeping in stables or under the trees, and listening to what people did not say as much as to what they said. They made perfect scouts. It would be a great loss if they had to be shifted to helping keep the city supplied. Rumor has Lord Luan 12 places east and west. Frowning at the much-creased map as though Luan's position should have been marked on it, Birgitta muttered a curse, much viler than called for, now that Rena Harfor was absent. Always the next village over or the one beyond that. Lady Alorian and Lord Abella seem to have vanished completely, difficult as that has to be for a high seat. At least Mistress Okolin and Mistress Fote haven't been able to find a whisper of them, or of any House Pendar or House Tremaine armsman either. Not a man or a horse. That was very unusual. Someone was exerting great effort. Abella was always a ghost when he wanted to be, Dailin muttered. Always able to catch you wrong-footed. Elorian. Brushing fingers against her lips, she sighed. The woman's too flamboyant to disappear. Unless she's with Abella or Luan. Or both of them. She was not happy with that idea, no matter what she said. As for our other friends, Birgitta said, Lady Arathella crossed out of Murundi 5 days ago, here. She touched the map lightly, some 200 miles south of Camelin. 4 days ago, Lord Pellavar crossed about 5 or 6 miles west of that, and Lady Aemlyn here, another 5 or 6 miles. Not together, Dailin said, nodding. Did they bring any Murandians? No? Good. They could be moving to their estates, Elaine. If they move further apart, we'll know for certain. Those 3 houses made her most anxious of all. They could be heading home, Birgitta agreed, reluctantly as always when agreeing with Dailin. Drawing her intricate braid over her shoulder, she gripped it in a fist almost the way Nynaeve did. The men and horses must be worn out after marching into Murundi in winter, but all we can be sure of is that they're on the move. Avienda snorted. With her in elegant velvets, it was a startling sound. Always assume your enemy will do what you do not want. Decide what you least want them to do and plan on that. Aemlyn, Arathella, and Pellavar aren't enemies, Dailin protested weakly. Wherever she believed their allegiance would fall in time, those 3 had announced their support of Dailin herself for the throne. Elaine had never read of any queen being forced onto the throne. That sort of thing might not have made it into the histories in any case. Yet Aemlyn, Arathella, and Pellavar seemed willing to try, and not for hope of power for themselves. Dailin did not want the throne, but she would hardly be a passive ruler. The simple fact was that Morghese Trakan's final year had been marred by blunder after blunder, and few knew or believed that she had been a captive of one of the Forsaken during that time. Some houses wanted anyone except another Trakand on the throne, or thought they did. "What is the last thing we want them to do?" Elaine said. "If they disperse to their estates, then they are out of it until spring at the earliest, and everything will be decided by then. The light willing it would. But if they continue on to Camelin? Without the Murundians, they don't have enough armsmen to challenge Aramilla. Studying the map, Birgitta rubbed her chin. If they don't know by now that the Aiel and the Legion of the Dragon are staying out of this, they'll have to learn of it soon, but they'll want to be careful. None of them seems foolish enough to provoke a fight they can't win when they don't have to. I'd say they'll camp somewhere to the east or southeast where they can keep an eye on events and maybe influence what happens. Downing the last of her wine, which must have been cold by now, Dailan exhaled heavily and walked over to fill her cup again.
"If they come to Camelin," she said in a leaden tone, "then they are hoping that Luan or Abella or Elorian will join them. Perhaps all three."
"Then we must figure out how to stop them reaching Camelin before our plans come to fruit, without making them permanent enemies." Elaine worked to make her voice as sure and firm as Dialin's was dull. "And we must plan what to do in case they arrive here too early. If that happens, Dailan, you will have to convince them the choice is between me and Aramilla. Otherwise, we'll be in a tangle we may never straighten out, and all of Andor in it with us." Dailan grunted as if she had been punched. The last time the great houses split evenly among three claimants for the Lion Throne had been nearly 500 years ago, and 7 years of open war followed before a queen was crowned. The original claimants were all dead by that point. Without thinking, Elaine picked up her teacup and took a sip. The tea had gone cold, but honey exploded on her tongue. Honey? She looked at Avienda in astonishment, and her sister's lips quirked in a small smile. A conspiratorial smile, as if Birgitta did not know exactly what had happened. Even their strangely enhanced bond did not extend to her tasting what Elaine did, yet she'd surely felt Elaine's surprise and pleasure on tasting the tea. Planting fists on hips, she adopted a censorious look. Or rather, she tried to. Despite all she could do, a smile crept onto her face, too. Abruptly, Elaine realized that Birgitta's headache was gone. She did not know when it had vanished, but it certainly was not there any longer. "Hope for the best and plan for the worst," she said. "Sometimes the best actually happens." Dailan, unaware of the honey or anything except that they were all three grinning, harumphed loudly.
"And sometimes it doesn't happen. If your clever scheme comes off exactly as planned, Elaine, we won't have any need for Aemlyn or Elorian or the others, but it's a terrible gamble. All it takes to go wrong is..."
The left-hand door opened to admit a wave of cold, and an apple-cheeked woman with icy eyes and the golden knot of an under-lieutenant on her shoulder. She might have knocked first, but if so, the ward had sealed off the sound. Like Rasoria, Saigun Sakurin had been a hunter for the horn before joining Elaine's bodyguard. It seemed the guard had changed.
"The wise one Monaella wishes to see the Lady Elaine," Saigun announced, drawing herself up rigidly. "Mistress Karistovan is with her."
Sumiko could be put off, but not Monaella. Aramilla's people would as soon interfere with Aes Sedai as with the Aiel, yet only something important would have brought a wise one into the city. Birgitta knew that, too. She immediately began folding the map up again. Avienda let the warding dissipate and released the source. "Ask them to come in," Elaine said. Monaella did not wait on Saigun, gliding into the room as soon as the ward vanished, her multitude of gold and ivory bracelets rattling as she lowered her shawl from shoulders to elbows in the comparative warmth. Elaine did not know how old Monaella was. Wise ones were not as reticent about age as Aes Sedai, but they were oblique. Yet she appeared not far into her middle years. There were hints of red in her waist-long yellow hair, but not a touch of grey. Short for an Aiel, shorter than Elaine, with a mild, motherly face, she was barely strong enough in the power to have been accepted into the White Tower, but strength did not count among wise ones, and among them she stood very high. More importantly for Elaine and Avienda, she had been the midwife at their rebirth as first sisters. Elaine offered her a curtsy, ignoring Dialin's disapproving sniff, and Avienda made a deep bow, folding herself over her hands. Aside from the duties owed to her midwife under Aiel customs, she was still only an apprentice-wise one after all.
"I assume your need for privacy is ended since you lowered the ward," Monaella said.
"And it is time I checked on your condition, Elaine Trakand. It should be done twice in the month until full term." Why was she frowning at Avienda? Oh, light, the velvets.
"And I have come to see what she does," Sumiko added, following the wise one into the room. Sumiko was imposing, a stout woman with confident eyes, in well-cut, red-belted yellow wool, with silver combs in her straight black hair, and a red-enameled silver circle pin on the high neck of her dress. She might have been a noblewoman or a successful merchant. Once she had shown a certain diffidence, at least, around Aes Sedai, but no longer. Not with Aes Sedai or soldiers of the Queen's Guards. "You may go," she told Saigon. "This doesn't concern you, or with nobles, for that matter. You may leave, too, Lady Dailin, and you, Lady Birgitta." She studied Avienda as if considering adding her to the list. "Avienda may remain," Monaella said. "She is missing a great many lessons, and she must learn this sooner or later." Sumiko nodded in acceptance of Avienda, but she kept a coolly impatient gaze on Dailin and Birgitta. "Lady Dailin and I have matters to discuss," Birgitta said, stuffing the folded map back under her red coat as she started for the door. "I'll tell you tonight what we've thought of, Elaine." Dailin gave her a sharp look, almost as sharp as the one she had given Sumiko, but she set her wine cup on one of the trays and made her courtesies to Elaine, then waited with visible impatience while Birgitta bent to murmur at length in Monaella's ear, and the wise one replied briefly but just as quietly. What were they whispering about? Probably goat's milk. Once the door closed behind Saigon and the other two women, Elaine offered to send for more wine, since what was in the pitchers was cold, but Sumiko declined curtly, and Monaella politely, if rather absently. The wise one was studying Avienda with such intensity that the younger woman began to redden and looked away, gripping her skirts. "You mustn't take Avienda to task about her clothes, Monaella," Elaine said. "I asked her to wear them, and she did, as a favor to me." Pursing her lips, Monaella thought before answering. "First sisters should give one another favors," she said finally. "You know your duty to our people, Avienda. So far you have done well at a difficult task. You must learn to live in two worlds, so it is fitting that you become comfortable in those clothes." Avienda began to relax, until Monaella continued. "But not too comfortable. From now on you will spend every third day and night in the tents. You can return with me tomorrow. You have a great deal to learn yet before you can become a wise one, and that is as much your duty as is being a binding cord." Elaine reached out and took her sister's hand, and when Avienda tried to let go after one squeeze, she held on. After a brief hesitation, Avienda clung too. In a strange way, having Avienda there had comforted Elaine for the loss of Rand. She was not only a sister, but a sister who also loved him. They could share strength and make each other laugh when they wanted to cry, and they could cry together when that was needed. One night in three alone very likely meant one night in three weeping alone. Light! What was Rand doing? That awful beacon to the west was still blazing as strongly as ever, and she was certain that he was in the heart of it. Not one particle had changed in the bond with him, but she was certain. Suddenly she realized that she had a crushing grasp on Avienda's hand, and Avienda was holding hers as fiercely. They loosened their grips at the same instant. Neither let go, however. "Men cause trouble even when they are elsewhere," Avienda said softly. "They do," Elaine agreed. Monaella smiled at the exchange. She was among the few who knew about the bonding of Rand and who the father of Elaine's baby was. None of the kinswomen did, though. "I'd think you've let a man cause you all the trouble he could, Elaine," Sumiko said primly. The kin's rule followed the rules for novices and accepted, forbidding not only children but anything that might lead to them, and they held to it strictly. Once a kinswoman would have swallowed her tongue before suggesting an Aes Sedai fell short of their rule. Much had changed since then, however. "I'm supposed to travel to Tyr today so I can bring back a shipment of grain and oil tomorrow, and it is growing late. So if you are done talking about men, I suggest you let Monaella get on with what she came for."
Monaella positioned Elaine in front of the fireplace, close enough that the heat from the nearly consumed logs was near to uncomfortable. It was best if the mother was very warm, she explained. Then the glow of Sidar surrounded her, and she began to weave threads of spirit and fire and earth. Avienda watched almost as avidly as Sumiko. "What is this?" Elaine asked, as the weave settled around her and sank into her. "Is it like delving?" Every Aes Sedai in the palace had delved her, though only Marilla had sufficient skill with healing for it to be much use. But neither they nor Sumiko had been able to say much more than that she was with child. She felt a faint tingling, a sort of hum inside her flesh. "Don't be silly, girl," Sumiko said absently. Elaine raised an eyebrow and even thought of waving her great serpent ring under Sumiko's nose, but the round-faced woman did not appear to notice. She might not have noticed the ring, either. She was leaning forward, peering as though she could see the weave inside Elaine's body. "The wise ones learned about healing from me. And from Nynaeve, I suppose," she allowed after a moment. Oh, Nynaeve would have gone up like an illuminator's firework hearing that. But then Sumiko had outstripped Nynaeve long since. "And they did learn the simple form from Aes Sedai." A snort like ripping canvas showed what Sumiko thought of the simple form, the only sort of healing Aes Sedai had known for thousands of years. "This is something of the wise one's own." "It is called caressing the child," Monaella said in an abstracted voice. Most of her attention was focused on the weave. A simple delving to learn what ailed someone, it was simple, come to think, would have been finished by now, but she altered the flows, and the hum inside Elaine changed pitch, sinking deeper. "It may be some part of healing, a sort of healing, but we have known this since before we were sent to the Threefold Land. Some of the ways the flows are used are similar to what Sumiko Karastovan and Nynaeve Almira showed us. In caressing the child, you learn the health of mother and child, and by changing the weaves you can cure some problems of either, but they will not work on a woman who is not with child, or on a man, of course." The hum grew louder until it seemed everyone must be able to hear it. Elaine thought her teeth were vibrating. An earlier thought returned to her, and she said, "Will channeling hurt my child? If I channel, I mean." "No more than breathing does." Monaella let the weave vanish with a grin. "You have two. It is too early to say whether they are girls or boys, but they are healthy, and so are you." "Two." Elaine shared a wide smile with Avienda. She could almost feel her sister's delight. She was going to have twins. Rand's babies. A boy and a girl, she hoped, or two boys. Twin girls would present all manner of difficulties for the succession. No one ever gained the rose crown with everyone behind her. Sumiko made an urgent sound in her throat, gesturing toward Elaine, and Monaella nodded. "Do exactly as I did, and you will see." Watching Sumiko embrace the source and form the weave, she nodded again, and the round kinswoman let it sink into Elaine, letting out a gasp as if she felt the humming herself. "You will not have to worry about birthing sickness," Monaella went on, "but you will find that you have difficulty in channeling sometimes. The threads may slip away from you as though greased, or fade like mist, so you will have to try again and again to make the simplest weave or hold it. This may grow worse as your pregnancy progresses, and you will not be able to channel at all while in labor or giving birth, but it will come right after the children are born. You soon will become moody, too, if that has not already started, weepy one minute and snarling the next. The father of your child will be wise to step warily and keep his distance as much as he can." "I hear she's already snapped his head off once this morning," Sumiko muttered. Releasing the weave, she straightened and adjusted her red belt around her girth. "This is remarkable, Monaella. I never thought of a weave that could only be used on a pregnant woman." Elaine's mouth tightened, but what she said was, "You can tell all of that with this weave, Monaella?" It was best that people thought her babes were Doilan Melars. Randall Thor's children would be targets, stalked for fear or advantage or hatred. But no one would think twice about Melar's, perhaps not even Melar. It was for the best, and that was that. Monella threw back her head, laughing so hard that she had to wipe a corner of her eyes with her shawl.
I knew this from bearing 7 children and having 3 husbands, Elaine Trekand. The ability to channel shields you from the birthing sickness, but there are other prices to pay. Come, Avienda, you must try too. Carefully now, exactly as I did.
Eagerly, Avienda embraced the source, but before she had begun to weave a thread, she let Sidar go and turned her head to stare toward the dark paneled wall, toward the west. So did Elaine and Monaella and Sumiko. The beacon that had been burning for so long had just vanished. One instant it had been there, that raging blaze of Sidar, and then it was gone as if it had never existed. Sumiko's massive bosom heaved as she drew a deep breath. I think something very wonderful or very terrible has happened today, she said softly. And I think I am afraid to learn which. Wonderful, Elaine said. It was done whatever it was, and Rand was alive. That was wonderful enough. Monella glanced at her quizzically. Knowing about the bond, she could puzzle out the rest, but she only fingered one of her necklaces in a thoughtful manner. In any case, she would pry it out of Avienda soon enough. A knock at the door made them all start. All but Monella, anyway. Pretending not to see the other women jump, she focused a little too intently on adjusting her shawl, which made the contrast all the greater. Sumiko coughed to hide her embarrassment. Come, Elaine said loudly. A half shout was necessary to be heard through the door, even without a ward. Kasela put her head into the room, plumed hat in hand, then came in the rest of the way and closed the door carefully behind her. The white lace at her neck and wrists was fresh, the lace and lions on her sash gleamed, and her breastplate sparkled as if freshly burnished, but obviously she had gone right back on duty after cleaning up from their overnight trip. Forgive me for interrupting, my lady, but I thought you should know right away. The sea folk are in a frenzy, those that are still here. It seems one of their apprentices has gone missing. What else? Elaine said. A missing apprentice might be bad enough, but something in Casela's face told her there was more. Guardswoman Azeri happened to tell me that she saw Marilla Sedai leaving the palace about 3 hours ago, Casela said reluctantly. Marilla and a woman who was cloaked and hooded. They took horses and a loaded pack mule. Urith said the second woman's hands were tattooed. My lady, no one had any reason to be looking for... Elaine waved her to silence. No one did anything wrong, Casela. No one will be blamed. Not among the guards, anyway. A fine pickle this was. Talan and Matara, the 2 apprentice windfinders, were very strong in the power, and if Marilla had been able to talk either one into trying to become Aes Sedai, she might have been able to convince herself that taking the girl where she could be entered into the novice book was reason enough to evade her own promise to teach the windfinders. Who would be more upset over losing Marilla, and more than furious over the apprentice? They would blame everyone in sight, and Elaine most of all. Is this general knowledge about Marilla? She asked. Not yet, my lady, but whoever saddled their horses and loaded that mule won't hold their tongues. Stable hands don't have much to gossip about. More of a brush fire than a pickle, then, and small chance of putting it out before it reached the barns. I hope you will dine with me later, Monaella, Elaine said, but you must forgive me now. Duty to her midwife or no, she did not wait for the other woman's assent. Trying to douse the fire might be enough to stop the barns from catching, maybe. Casela, inform Birgitta and tell her I want an order sent to the gates immediately to watch for Marilla. I know. She may be out of the city already, and the gate guards won't stop an Aes Sedai anyway. But maybe they can delay her, or frighten her companion into scuttling back into the city to hide. Sumiko, would you ask Rihanna to assign every kinswoman who can't travel to start searching through the city? It's a small hope, but Marilla may have thought it was too late in the day to start out. Check every inn, including the Silver Swan, and... She hoped Rand had done something wonderful today, but she could not waste time even thinking about that now. She had a throne to gain and angry Atha Anmier to deal with. Before they could vent their anger on her, it was to be hoped. In short, it was a day like every other since she returned to Camelin, and that meant her hands were quite full enough.